Hi, and welcome to the Arizona State Sports and Entertainment Law Journal's podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Professor Michael Leloy. Professor Michael Leloy works at the School of Labor and Employment Relations and College of Law at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We had the pleasure of meeting based on an article that Professor Leloy submitted to the Arizona State Sports and Entertainment Law Journal, which was published in our fall 2020 issue, which is volume 10, issue 1. The title of Professor Leloy's article is Whitewashing Coaching Racism in NCAA Sports, Enforcing Civil Rights Through the Ku Klux Klan Act, and that's the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871. So, Professor, thank you for coming on air with us.
Thank you, Brandon.
And please, like this, one thing that excited me about this article is how you're using a late 19th century act to apply to modern NCAA sports. So, can you please like draw the bridge between the two?
Certainly. It actually began outside the sports arena, but in the context of what is happening in our society. So Charlottesville was a deeply troubling event that really shook me to my core in 2017. And I have been publishing in the area of employment and labor law for a long period of time. But it dawned on me that we have people in our society who are not only racist, but they're well organized. And to cut to the chase, it also occurred to me that our current employment laws, for example, Title VII, which prohibits race discrimination, aren't necessarily cut out to deal with the worst forms of white supremacy and similar forms of racism. So I researched this and looked into it. And the long story short is, I published research that dealt with white supremacy in the workplace generally. So that work was published in the Stanford Law and Policy Review in 2018. Quite apart from that, I've been involved with my own university's athletic program out of a love for sports. And I'm very proud of what our university does, and I'm proud of what NCAA athletics provides for many student athletes. And I can't get into specifics except to say that in my role as the chairperson of this athletic board, two parents contacted me with concerns that they had about their allegations, and they're no more than allegations, of racist treatment of their players and their sons and other players on the team. Well, this has already been published, at least in our local news media. I and a professor on the board with me, we took our concerns to the administration. And the long story short is we were told that those matters were investigated and they were discredited. Those allegations were discredited. Personally, this is my opinion, I wasn't pleased with that particular outcome. Now let's talk more specifically about what happened and what is clearly documented is six of our basketball players transferred, and they transferred with the prospect of losing eligibility. That's half the basketball team. And anybody who watches college basketball will be struck by the number of people who transferred and transferred in a way that didn't allow them to move to get some to retain their eligibility. Also, what struck me is one of our players did get eligibility immediately with our rival, our most direct rival. And from a fan perspective, that doesn't add up. So what the article conjectures, and openly conjectures, but uses public source reporting, it conjectures that there could have been some coordination to allow this player to move to another school if he didn't openly complain. Now, to get to your question about the Ku Klux Klan Act, it had never occurred to me until Charlottesville that we do have a lightly used civil rights law that actually was enacted after the Civil War to address exactly what we see happening at Charlottesville and these kinds of orchestrated campaigns to intimidate both black people, but also the people who are not a minority, but are stepping up to support them. And that's a very important part of the conversation. So we've had an underutilized statute. It is utilized to some extent, but I think the nature of our times, as troubling as there are, invite us to make more, to update the use of this Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871.
Great. I mean, yeah, again, like that was one of the things that really drew me to this, you know, being, a lover of history and finding out, you know, that this could still be applicable, even in, you know, 2020 and moving into 2021. So, your article addresses, the idea of like a conspiracy. And can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, sure. When the Ku Klux Klan Act was enacted, there were federal troops in the states that seceded, and they were dealing with organized violence conducted by the Klan and its various sub-branch units. But this campaign that was mounted by the Ku Klux Klan was a multi-pronged campaign. It focused on intimidating blacks and northerners who had come down to, for example, teach blacks how to read and to educate them. The campaign focused on not only discouraging them from voting, but threatening them with death. At its worst forms, it culminated in blacks and their supporters being whipped, taken out of their home, shot, lynched. And so Congress was not a monolithic group. They were divided as we have today, but there were enough, we would call them progressives. At the time they were called radical Republicans. They were concerned, and we had a president who was in the South and he was combating this directly, and it's Ulysses S. Grant. And so the combination of having a political majority in Congress and a general who knew what this terror campaign looked like resulted in this legislation. And it has two parts, one criminal, one civil, but both dealt with conspiracies. And so the phrasing, and this is one of the downfalls of the statute, the phrasing is very overly literalistic and tightly scripted to the circumstances. So there are several passages to the act, but I'll just get to one main point, which says, when two or more persons go in disguise on a highway. Well, that is describing the Ku Klux Klan at night on horseback in sheets ready to terrorize and effectuating a racial terror campaign. So the idea behind the conspiracy was many of these clans formulated their plans in hiding and effectuated them under the cover of a sheet. And so the idea behind a conspiracy was the law was aimed at addressing not just the act of terror, which would be shooting or burning or something like this, but the planning. The lawmakers understood that it began with planning, and it began with covert planning. And the covert planning was orchestrated by politically influential people in communities. These were respectable people who found, in effect, henchmen. It was very interesting from a class perspective. It was the moneyed class acting with the dispossessed poor white class to engage in a coordinated terror campaign. So even though the language was overly literalistic, it did contemplate sort of the process by which these terror activities are carried out. It understood that these were not random acts of violence, that they were part of a systemic plan or systematic plan to drive northern whites out of the South to and that gets into sort of the article. What was new about this piece for me and different from my research in 2018, my research in 2018 looked at the employment side. So what was done to narrow or just to in effect recreate slavery in the form of peonage. But what made this a new endeavor in the article that your journal has published, I went back and read the legislative record, and I asked the question, what about the racial terror campaign was focused on schools and education? Because that's what my article deals with, is this idea that schools cover up blatant racism. And so I was trying to figure out, is there an historical comparison? And I did find it. And Brandon, the one thing that I will say that sort of triggered the connection was when I was doing the research on employment, I recalled reading about a man named John Dunlop, who was a teacher. He came from Ohio, and he was teaching in a southern state. I believe it was Mississippi. I can't recall exactly. But in any event, he was dragged from his home. He was a very idealistic person, and he thought that he should be part of educating freed slaves to read and to be ready to participate in the new America. And so he had a public school, and it was well known in the community. He was taken from his home late at night, as was a black man in the community. They were both taken some long distance on horseback, taken to a swamp. They were stripped naked, and they were beaten with leather straps. And they were told, get out of town, 48 hours, get out of town. But what struck me, Brandon, was that's a school story. That's not an employment story. Mm-hmm. And so that became sort of the inspiration for, can I find more instances where lawmakers were concerned not just about jobs for newly freed blacks, but educating people? And in fact, Congress was concerned about that.
Wow, that's that's a lot to handle. So,
it is. I mean, I was overwhelmed by this. I if you're feeling overwhelmed, and if a listener's feeling overwhelmed, I have to say that when I was researching this, I was, you know, partly trembling with outrage that this could happen, and just amazed at how pervasive this. The Klan's campaign was. And again, Ben, I'm going to throw this back to, so where did I get the impetus for this? There's that weekend of Charlottesville, and many people who are listening to this podcast probably recall that weekend well, and whatever your reactions are, they'll probably stick with you. And so, you know, I was just thinking, it was overwhelming to process 2017, that whole thing, and I guess I'm not at the end point, but this research gave me more insight as to how this could come about.
Sure, absolutely. And can you talk a little bit more specifically about, like, putting this in the modern NCAA context? Because your article it does address this, continuing on the idea of the conspiracy, the conspiracy between the official university officials and the NCAA in silencing. In silencing complaints, essentially.
Yeah. Sure. First, I've got to say that my university is not isolated. And so part of what we've seen the past few years are athletes speaking up and speaking out and calling out coaches who have used slurs or worse. And this is after we published this article, but just for perspective, a very successful coach at Wichita State, Greg Marshall, he was removed from his job because it came out well after the fact that he too engages in racist kinds of, it's more than just language. So language in itself, part of what my article exposes is that the Klan in the 1860s and early 1870s, they used the N-word. They used this language. Verbally degrading people was part and parcel of physically hurting them. And so that threads back to the article, the NCAA context, where many of the stories that are told about coaches that engage in this behavior, it's more than, oops, he said something or she said something, but they're female coaches who do this. It's also part of a pattern of degrading the individual psychologically, telling them that they're worthless, they're not, they're coming from a ghetto background, they're and using that stereotyping. So there's this emotional, psychological beating the person down, and then there's a physical component, whether it's excessive, exercise punishment or physical, throwing things at people. And so I found many examples of this, and I concluded that what I observed on my campus was part of a larger pattern. So with respect to what we're doing in the article here, we're looking at the timeline, and I'm really grateful that we're publishing this. There's a timeline. It's very public. What I did is I used public sourcing to, whether it was in my community or in the St. Louis media or Chicago or Columbia, Missouri, which are relevant points, or national, but I meticulously recreated a timeline of how each of these six athletes who left our campus, you know, where did they go and what was the outcome? And the long story short is our university did not conduct its investigation into allegations of racist treatment of players until after the six players left. I found that stunning. I found it stunning that our own athletic director admitted in a public interview that he had talked to the Missouri athletic director about a waiver for Mark Smith, a really good freshman athlete who moved. We don't know, by the way, the record will show that he never complained about, he never verbalized why he was moving. In the article, I point out where I don't have conclusive information, where there are gaps. So why did this player move? We don't know, but we do know he moved at a time when there were allegations of complaints about racist treatment. And we also know from published materials that the investigation didn't begin until he was at Missouri. And we also know that the NCAA didn't approve his waiver until roughly October 27th. That would be about a week before he would begin playing at Missouri. Now, look, it could be that the delay is simply because the NCAA is got a lot of things to look at. They didn't get to it. But it also could be, it could reflect some sort of agreement that he has to remain silent right up until the point where he wants to get on the floor and play. And so I was just struck by to me, it's not honest to say that you conducted an investigation when the six players who left had, they were given a standard exit interview. We know that. A standard exit interview is not the same as an investigatory interview.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, from my understanding, the publication of this article is kind of, it's many steps ahead in the process, but also, kind of looking ahead to where you are looking to take this and the change that you're looking to effectuate. Can you talk about, where you see this going, or what are your next steps in kind of getting this information out there, aside from our podcast?
Sure. Well, the Senate is taking up a bill that's sponsored by Cory Booker and Richard Blumenthal, and it's going to create a Bill of Rights. It's going to try to create a Bill of Rights for NCAA athletes. There's a financial component. That seems to be the major component. But there's also an element that deals with creating a Commission for Health, Safety, and Welfare of Players. And that part is relevant to my paper. And so what I observed at Illinois and what I've observed in my research, so what happened at Illinois, I believe, is very standard operating practice. And in fact, Arizona State University had the first and only Ku Klux Klan Act case that was adjudicated on the merits before the U.S. Supreme Court. And that goes back, Brandon, to the early 1980s, that case. But the connection is a player, and this is on film, there was a punter for Arizona State, and he performed poorly in a game, and the head coach, Frank Cush, came over and shook his head violently with his helmet on and ripped off his helmet and punched him in the face. And so the Ku Klux Klan Act part of the case was, who would ever think that would apply? It was a white punter punched by a coach. But if you read the language of the act, it talks about a conspiracy to interfere with one's civil rights And then it gets specific as to interfere in participating in a state court proceeding. Now, the context for that, Brandon, was think back on the 1860s, 1870s, that would be a black man or a white supporter going to court to complain about the terrorism of the Ku Klux Klan. And so the law was to say, if people interfere with your ability to access the courts, you will pay a price for that, criminally and civilly. Okay, so now we'll go ahead a century later. The issue in that case was, the allegation was that Coach Cush and the Arizona State Senior Athletic and University Administration intimidated witnesses from not testifying. Brandon, that is a Ku Klux Klan picture. So the university defended by saying the act was passed to protect black people from racist treatment. And the Supreme Court, in a decision from John Paul Stevens, said, no, it's not just plaintiffs are not only black. They can be a white person when there's a conspiracy to interfere with a white person's participation in a court proceeding. So we have one case on the merits already that has revived the Ku Klux Klan Act. And what I'm doing in our article here is saying, going forward, to the extent that athletic programs have claims of racist treatment of players and they silence players either with these quid pro quo agreements, you don't file a lawsuit and we'll hand out the carrot of immediate eligibility. That's what I'm conjecturing openly in the paper is a possible outcome here, or whether it's the reverse side, you won't do it or else we'll blackball you, we'll make sure you never play anywhere else. Whatever the mechanism is, I do think it's appropriate. The statute can be invoked and can be used. So my hope is that these materials can be looked at in the Senate. And to get to the bottom line, when a powerful institution, in this case it would be a Power Five conference school, investigates itself and is not there's no transparency and there's no accountability outside the system, those are the conditions where abuse of rights can occur. So my hope is this legislation is enacted and provides external reporting and accountability mechanisms.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I think that's, you know, in my brief time in legal studies and, you know, amateur sports law courses that I've taken, the kind of external reporting, you know, in light of, you know, social media and the fact that we are kind of taking in information at an unprecedented rate, having that kind of external objective, you know, review process is only going to become more important, I think, moving forward. So, yeah, thank you very much. And do you have, is there anything else that you would like to add about the article or let the listeners know?
I'll add one brief element. There's both over the statute has been, the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871 is still here today. Its criminal law provision was struck down as unconstitutional shortly after the bill was enacted. It was revived a century later with the James Byrd and Matthew Shepard hate crime bill. So I would just tell listeners, when you hear about hate crimes, that's the term we use today. That is part and parcel a recreation and a reassertion of federal criminal jurisdiction in these matters. And so the point I'm trying to make is that it took the brutal killing of James Byrd and the brutal killing of Matthew Shepard because he was gay. It was a hate crime against the LGBTQ plus community. But the point I'm trying to make is after a century of neglecting these core civil rights laws, society is ready to think about reinfusing them and applying them to current contexts. So I thank you for publishing the article. I hope it's a step in the direction of testing the statute under these conditions. And my prediction, everything is fact specific, is that there are cases out there where the interesting part to think about is it creates personal liability for people who are involved in the conspiracy. So if you have an athletic director, if you have a university chancellor or president, if you have a coach, just three or four people who are powerful, who are coordinating with this, if you have an NCAA office that is helping to facilitate this transfer process to silence a player, they can be held personally liable. And if you have personal liability, then you have deterrence. Then people will, I think, pause and say, you know, maybe we shouldn't cover up. Maybe we should address the core issue. Let's look into this and let's be transparent about it.
Sure. Yeah, that's fantastic. And, first and foremost, thank you again for coming on the podcast. But for our listeners, I do hope that you pick up a copy of Professor LeRoy's article. Our journal, the Arizona State Sports Entertainment Law Journal, is available on Amazon. It is also available online on our website, which is www.asuselj.org. And you can read his individual article there, or you can check out the entire issue. So, this is a very, very powerful piece. It certainly impacted not only me, but my entire executive board and the associate editors who worked on this. So, thank you for, considering our journal, and we were honored to be able to publish it.
Well, thank you so much. I truly appreciate that we found a connection here in terms of my putting the work out and your being receptive and understanding the importance. And that's the next step. We can only hope that somebody else will take interest in it and push this idea forward.
I agree. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to sit down and talk with me today. And we look forward to seeing the next steps in this process.
Thank you, Brandon.
All right, bye.